Yeah, you already know. Come on. You know what time it is.
Hey, yo, I represent Queens.
Please, let them know.
Live and direct from the 718, Queens Stand Up. I'm really excited because the guest that we have today has nothing to do with baseball or basketball, but it's someone I met a long time ago. She probably doesn't even remember, but I started reading her work on when she was with the Village Voice. Her name is Rachel Kramer-Bussell. She is a writer, editor, teacher, and event organizer. She is the author of numerous books, just to name a few. Sex and Cupcakes, a juicy collection of essays. Come Again, Sex to Erotica, which she sent to me, and I'm halfway through. Thank you very much. But she writes about sex, dating, books, and pop culture, and teaches erotica writing workshops across the country. Later on, you can give your website and your Twitter handle. Welcome to the show, Rachel. Thank you for being on the MIA3 podcast.
So, thank you.
Are you a sex columnist? What would you say you are? Because reading a lot of your work, I feel like your writing kind of is really diverse.
It's funny because I actually am a sex columnist, but that's hardly ever what I say first. Like, usually I just say writer because I'm interested in a lot of topics. And because I've been writing about sex for a long time, almost 15 years, you know, often that's what I write about, both because people ask me to write about it, and, you know, I am interested in it, but I think if I only wrote about sex, I don't think I could do that. Like, I think I would get bored.
Bored with sex, come on.
Well, not bored with sex, but I think I would feel sort of antsy to write about other things. So, you know, I really, like, those are the main topics I write about, but sometimes I write about technology. Sometimes I write about body image. Today, I wrote a really, really weird story about this nutscaping, which is photos that men take with their balls, like, dangling over a landscape. It's really bizarre. If you look up Netscape, go to netscape.com.
Yeah, so I did.
You can see some of these.
Yeah, I did take a quick look. I was like, what am I looking at right now?
What category is that in? I mean, it's not really about sex. It's kind of about nudity. It's mostly just about something super bizarre. But literally, I wrote that for Salon, and I write for them pretty frequently, pretty much whenever they ask me to. My editor there this morning said, hey, this weird thing is going on. Do you want to write about it? And I said, sure. And I kind of feel like I'm okay with being the person who's their go-to, like, something where it's a little bit sexy, nudity, you know, strange is going on. Like, will you write about it?
And you're like, no problem. I got it.
I mean, sometimes, the only times when I'll turn something down because of, you know, the content versus, you know, being busy or traveling or something is if it's something I literally don't know anything about and don't think I can, you know, research it, like, especially if it's something medical. I mean, sometimes I will write about, you know, something like that. Like, last week I wrote a piece about breast cancer, but I called three people I know who've dealt with breast cancer.
Right.
And, you know, I felt okay about using their words and linking to other people, but I tend to prefer to write about something that at least, you know, I don't feel, you know, that I can feel confident about what I'm saying. I mean, and I would say I always feel confident, but sometimes, you know, it's just so out of my element, I don't think it would be worth all the trouble of researching it, you know, if there's someone else who already knows tons about it. So, like, if I'm pitching articles, I try to bring up topics that I already either have a strong opinion about or I'm curious about, or it's an author that I want to interview whose book I was going to read anyway or something like that. But, you know, I don't really call myself a sex writer or a sex columnist or even, I mean, I do call myself an erotica writer, but I feel like part of why I can stay interested in all those different things is because I do a bunch of different kinds of writing, and I also do editing, and I also do teaching.
No, absolutely. I mean, even in, I guess, MIA3 Network's about maybe a year and 3 months. And when myself or Ryan want to talk about something a little bit different than what we're normally used to talking about, we interview someone who we know, and it's really about your circle. And it's just like, you know, it seems that your circle, you have friends, unfortunately, who've dealt with breast cancer, and you're able to talk to them about that. You know, I've interviewed people on deportation.
And I think, like, social media has helped a lot, because I can't think of a specific example right this second, but there have been times when I didn't know an expert and I needed one, and I just searched, like, let's say it was human rights lawyer. That's not a real example, but, you know, I would search online, like, who's a human rights lawyer who's active on social media that I figure would respond quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, I think that, you know, you can find people, but, you know, overall, there's sort of pretty loose categories. I mean, not loose, but there's a few main categories of stuff that I write about, but I feel like I would never say, oh, I'll never write about, like, sports. Like, it's funny because you just mentioned sports, and, like, I really don't follow sports that much, but if something, you know, is happening that everyone is talking about, like, I will follow it.
Like the World Series right now with the Mets?
You know, I'll know a little bit about what's going on, but I wouldn't, like, if someone said, oh, can you write about, like, the World Series or the whatever, I mean, or the Super Bowl or something, I would say no, because, I mean, but what else, someone probably wouldn't ask me to write about that, because it's just not my field of interest. But
right.
I do, like, I read about all sorts of different things, and I love when, you know, one thing I read or a movie I watch or whatever, like, leads me to something else, but leads me to something else, and I will, like, totally go down that rabbit hole of reading everything about, like, whatever new thing I'm interested in until I find something new to occupy my attention.
So would you say that, aside from being a writer, you're also a journalist then?
Yes.
And okay, cool.
That's not something I think, I didn't set out to do that. Actually, like, way back in 1995, I guess, when I was applying to grad school, I thought about applying to journalism school, but I wound up applying to law school, which I was also interested in, and, you know, I didn't finish law school, and I sort of then, I left law school and wasn't really sure what I was going to do, and I got an admin job, and that was really boring, but I was writing on the side, and there have been a lot of times since when I've thought, oh, well, I should have gone to journalism school, because at least then I could say I had a degree that I was using. And, you know, there's a part of me that, you know, I'm never going to like the fact that I didn't finish law school, just because it feels like a black mark, like a, you know, failure. But I think for someone who didn't go to journalism school, I've done pretty well. And I've sort of learned all the stuff I've learned just by doing it. And that, I think, this year I finally sort of let go of that, like, regret of, oh, I should have gone to journalism school because I wrote a piece for the New York Times. And that was so, you know, just such a huge honor and really exciting, and helped me realize, okay, pretty much if I want to do something, I can figure out a way to do it. You know, I mean, maybe I'm not saying I could write for literally every publication, but that just made me feel like, okay, you know, I don't have to feel stuck in only writing about sex, because that was about books and libraries.
Yeah, that was the book, hashtag bookface.
Yeah, and I would say, actually, if I had to pick one subject that I'm the most interested in, it's books, because, you know, that's really every, I mean, books could be about anything. I love books. Like, I could sit and talk about books all day, and I love when I'm either meeting with, you know, someone who works in publishing, or a librarian, or just super avid reader, and it doesn't even matter if we read the same thing. Like, even if they read science fiction and I don't read science fiction, I'm still interested in, like, how do you find new authors, and, you know, do you read series, and what, like, I would listen to what they read about, and I might even try something, even though it's not something I typically read.
Okay, cool. Speaking of books, we're going to jump back into erotica or erotic stories. So I was reading a book that you edited, The Come Again, Sex Toy Erotica, and I haven't read a novel or a collection of short stories about sex in a while. I think since, I want to say, college, I've been reading more articles, which I kind of learned about you the same time I learned about Dan Savage. But when I was younger, you know, I'm not going to lie, I went to an all-boy high school, and we passed around that, you know, that one novel. There's the magazine, and there's a novel, too. Some of us were a little more evolved. But it was a novel of, like, you know, and then the moonlight shone on them as they whatever, whatever. And it was definitely somewhat graphic, but what I kind of like about what I was reading is that it seems, and even some of your stories, that some stories you have for the New Yorker, it's just kind of a little bit more realistic. It's not as, I don't want to say not romantic, but that fake romantic that I think that
when you're growing up,
you're thinking like that Danielle Steele, RIP type of romance where it's like he came on his horse and picked her up
Fucked
and
her
like,
way, yeah.
yeah. It's like there was one that was interesting, and first I was like, I'm feeling this, and then I was like, wait a minute, this is real, even though I'm not dealing with this yet. But it was about the couple who was expecting and just not having time to have sex, and her going through kind of her own emotions, like, you know, kind of is he finding me attractive, you know, how her body's changed. And it's just like, it's erotic stories, but it's like stories. And, you know, or like one story in the book about they're away on business. And, you know, my girlfriend now, we've dealt with that because I travel for work and, you know, just kind of not going too deep into what happens, but just being able to relate, not being able to put yourself, having to put yourself in this medieval Game of Thrones type of atmosphere to read an erotic novel.
I feel like there's very broadly like two categories of erotic writing. I mean, there's lots of categories, but just that relate to this. There's the kind of like fantastical, you know, things that either probably would never happen or literally couldn't happen, you know, whether it's something set on another planet or, you know, someone turning into like a werewolf or turning into a different gender or just, I mean, yes, people can have a sex change, but, you know, like there's a story in the Big Book of Orgasms that I edited, and it's one of my favorite stories. It's hilarious, but it's also like underneath the humor, it's about these really big questions, and it's called Remote Control by Logan Zachary, and it's about a man and a woman, they're a couple, and they get this special remote control, and they can just zap it and like change the weather, change their hair color, and change their gender, and so they do, they change all these things, and then they're sort of looking at each other like, whoa, what happened to me, and what happened to you, and you know, it's written in a very funny way, but I think it makes you think about, okay, if you're in love with someone and partnered with someone and you're used to them looking and being a certain way, if you had a remote control, like, would you would you change them and would you let them change you? Like, I think it, even the sort of funny, crazy stories can make you ask yourself questions like that. But then on the other hand, to me, what makes some of the strongest stories work is that they are relatable, even if you haven't literally been in that situation. You know, maybe you've wondered, okay, like, does my partner still desire me, or I have this fantasy I want to try and I don't know how to bring it up with my partner, or, you know, something like that. And for me, the great part about editing anthologies is that I have room for usually, you know, in the range of 20 to 25 stories to play with all these kinds of ideas and present different, you know, styles of writing. Like, some are funnier and some are more intense and some are first person and some are third person. And, you know, I don't necessarily think every reader is going to love every story, but, you know, I want them to have a range of types of sex acts and sexuality and relationships. Like, I don't want it all to be, you know, first dates. And I don't, you know, if it's about couples, like my new one is called 30 Dates and it's all about couples, so those are all couples. But even within that, there's variety of what kinds of couples there are. And, you know, I tell my students, like, if they are writing about something that either is based on their life or is something that other people, you know, will relate to, they'll remember that story. You know, maybe it's about, like, worrying about aging, or, you know, maybe it's about not necessarily a worrying issue, but, you know, I think that if you can inject that real element, like, real life element, like, people read it in a different way.
Definitely. So I have a two-part question based off kind of what you just said. So, I mean, the first part is, do you think that the majority of Americans are kind of sexually conservative or sexually repressed? Because why I'm asking that is that when you said you work with your students and they kind of just open up into this whole new, or just not just students, but with other authors and you edit their stories, they kind of, it sounds like they kind of use sex as a platform to open up into other insecurities. So I guess that's a two-part question. Do you think that that in general Americans are kind of sexually repressed, sexually conservative, and those that use sex, do you kind of this use, they use it to kind of delve in deeper to other insecurities that are a real issue for them?
I think I'm going to try to answer the second one first.
Sure.
I think that when people are writing about sex, I mean, they're not just writing about sex, because sex is connected to so many other things. I think for a lot of people, your sexuality and your sexual desirability, like, go to the core of how you feel about yourself. So that ties into all sorts of other things, like, you know, body image and, you know, just how you value yourself. And it's not just about, like, you know, how you relate to someone else. I think this also applies to, you know, how we feel about ourselves. So I think that erotica it's not always going to tap into these topics. I mean, sometimes it is just going to be a sort of more lighthearted and fun, but I think it also can tap into those things. And you know, people ask me all the time, like, why do you think Fifty Shades of Grey was so popular? I don't necessarily have the answer, but I think that part of it was just this fantasy of about, yes, and it was sexual, but it was also about, you know, Christian Grey was taking care of everything for her, not just, you know, controlling her sexually, but, like, he was finding her a job and, you know, buying her this and, like, basically, you know, making her life a lot easier. I mean, yes, then there was drama, so it was complicated, but, you know, and I think that taps into, I mean, a larger conversation about money and, wouldn't we all want to be taken care of in that way? And I think that conversation often gets played out in the, you know, women who are, you know, partnered with men, are they going to, you know, be stay-at-home moms or housewives? Like, is the man going to, like, basically pay for everything? But I think that taps into a broader question of, like, would men want that if that was on the table? Like, would they want to stay home and not work? And how would that change the dynamic between a couple sexually? I mean, I think erotica can tap into some of these ideas. And, like, so I think often, and I think in the case of specifically BDSM erotica, you know, it's about the sex aspect, but I think it's also about how we deal with power in our everyday lives. And I think for a lot of people, you know, maybe they're really powerful in the office, and then at home they wanna be the one who's being dominated. You know, they wanna be told what to do because they're telling people what to do all day at the office. I mean, this isn't the case for everyone, but I think that element can play out in fiction.
Definitely.
And then in terms of whether Americans are oppressed, I don't know if I would say the majority of Americans are repressed so much as, you know, I think even though we've made a lot of progress in the last, let's say, 20 years, and I know that because when I was, like, I graduated high school, I was 17, I went to college, I really knew almost nothing about sex. I mean, I knew what it was, like, I knew some people who'd done it, I lost my virginity this summer between high school and college, but I really did not know the kinds of things that I hear, you know, teenagers and people in the college age range talking about now. I feel like they're much more informed about gender and sexual orientation and things like sex toys. I just feel like they have much more access to that kind of information, and there's more openness in terms of talking about it, and I think that we're going to see more and more of that, like, with future generations. I don't think there will be as much, I mean, there'll still be drama and, like, angst about, you know, crushes and dating and all that, but I don't think there will be so much, like, just misinformation, because I think that partly the internet, you know, they just have more information, but I think there's a more availability of those kinds of conversations. Maybe not for everyone. Like, yes, I think that there are still people who don't feel like they can talk about those things, whether it's a fantasy or a fetish or just like a regular conversation about sex with, maybe they can't talk about it with their partner, or maybe they can't talk about it with their friends. I think that definitely still exists. But I think that, you know, there's less and less of that, that isolation around sex, because I think even if you can't talk to your friends or you can't talk to people you know in real life, at least people can find those kinds of communities online. And I'm not saying that's a perfect substitute. I don't think it's a perfect substitute, but I think it's better than nothing.
Yeah, well, I think that definitely the online communities have been going on for a while. I mean, I'm a little bit, not too much younger than you, but I definitely think when I was, I want to say, like, you know, AOL and all that stuff came out when I was in the sixth grade, and as soon as we were able to, like, get in the chat rooms, it just kind of got out of control. I won't say out of control, but there definitely was just access for young people to talk about sex, and, you know, it's now I say it's a good thing, but then I look at, you know, maybe like younger cousins, and I'm like, oh my God, like, this is crazy, you know? Like,
I mean, yes, I think, you know, I think there's positives and negatives, and I think often, you know, teenagers might be pushed not by technology per se, but by their peers, you know, into talking, like, being more sexual than they want to be, you know, not, I'm not talking about being coerced into sex, but just sort of, you know, feeling like, oh, everyone else around me is doing it, like, I should be,
right,
if not doing it, like, pretending I'm more knowledgeable than I am. But I think that there are both resources, and there's just less stigma to being queer or being alternative, like, you know, not wanting to be monogamous. I think there's, those things are more mainstream. Or, you know, or being transgender, or questioning those things. Like, those were not topics that I feel like when I was in high school, I didn't even really think about those things because I didn't see them anywhere in, you know, pop culture or around me. And now those are topics that are on national television shows and in the news. And, like, and I think that we kind of sometimes assume, oh, well, you know, someone like Caitlyn Jenner, who's, you know, this very famous transgender person, is a role model for transgender people, which, you know, that might be true. But I think that it's not just about, oh, like, transgender people speak for transgender or to transgender people, and, you know, gay people are speaking to gay people. I mean, those people are also speaking to everyone else and being examples of, okay, you know, this is one way, you know, you can live your life. Because I think, you know, even if you're, let's say you're, you know, monogamous, and you're like 18, and maybe you meet the person you're going to be with the rest of your life, you're still also interacting with the rest of the world who might not be in that boat. And right. So, like, I think, you know, being able to talk about those things and being able to, you know, have friends of different sexual orientations and different interests, and just acknowledging that, you know, we're all different. Like, there's not one better or worse way to, like, have sex or do, or, you know, exist in the world, or even, like, you know, how we dress. I think that there's just more, I hope that there's more openness in terms of, you know, what we're allowed to say and do and look like, that affects sexuality, but also affects other things. And then, you know, sometimes I see things like with these school dress codes where I'm like, really, you're telling this girl, like, her tank top is too sexy? I mean, I think sometimes our culture is repressive and sort of tries to, first of all, slut shame, and second of all, just send this message that, like, sex is a bad thing until you're 18, and then it's all okay.
Yeah. You said a lot of things, and I just want to ask some questions. You said a lot of good talking points. First, this whole slut shaming thing. Are you? I am trying to understand it as best as I can, and I think the only way I'm kind of getting exposed to it is through articles and through, I guess, Amber Rose. So maybe you could explain to me and, you know, the listeners exactly what it is and. And also, do you agree with the way Amber Rose is going about it to shed light to the situation?
like with the slut walk?
Yes.
Well, okay, so I think, I mean, slut shaming, I would say, is a pretty broad category, and, you know, it's shaming someone, usually women, for being sexual or perceived as sexual. And the slut walk movement started, I think, in 2011. The Toronto police officer basically said, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but said something like, you know, if you don't want to be sexually assaulted, you know, shouldn't dress in a sexy way.
Right. That's been said, unfortunately, so many times in many different ways.
And, you know, as much as, like, that was a very over-the-top and clear way that women were being told, you know, conversely, basically, like, if you do dress in a certain way, then you're kind of responsible for someone assaulting you. I think that idea that, like, the way I dress makes me responsible for what someone else is going to, how they're going to judge me, I think that is much more broad than, you know, just that sort of worst case scenario or the most extreme examples. And I don't think in most cases the person saying those things would say they were slut shaming or would even think it. Like, I'm sure that police officer was actually trying, and I don't mean to defend that statement, I'm not, but I'm saying, like, I don't think they intended it to sound the way it did, and I think that people don't always realize, like, they're trying to be helpful sometimes, and sometimes they're not. Sometimes I think they're just trying to say, well, I think what you're wearing, you know, is inappropriate, or I think what you're doing is inappropriate, but I think there's other cases where there's, you know, I think there's been changes in our culture where, you know, women have said, you know what, like, I can wear a bra out as my top and, like, that's okay. Or, you know, in New York State, it's legal to be topless. And that has been a movement, the right to be topless, which I think is related to this Free the Nipple movement on Instagram where women are saying, why should men be allowed to be shirtless in photos and we're not? And I think these things are related in the fact that, you know, women are just tired of other people trying to police how we dress and how what we do with our bodies. And that could include how we dress, but also, you know, what we do otherwise. Like this idea that if you act too forward or you shouldn't, you know, lead someone on. And, you know, like, I think there's just all these ideas that are sort of part of an older generation's way of thinking about sex that kind of go into a lot of the slut-shaming. And it's not just men slut-shaming women. Like, women, I think, can also slut-shame.
Right, I was going to bring that up. That it definitely really goes both ways at the time. No, it's okay, sorry.
There's a really great website, the Unslut Project, by this woman, Emily Linden, and she started it by just sharing her, I think it was middle school diaries, where she was slut-shamed, and, you know, I think rumors were made up about her, and she was kind of bullied, and she, you know, survived and went on to, you know, have a productive life, but when there were the series of suicides by teenagers who were being bullied at school and, you know, for being slutty or for, you know, having been at a party and photos were taken of them and, you know, in a sexual manner in these various cases, she was inspired to start this website. And a lot of girls and women have shared examples of, you know, what they've gone through. And they also have a documentary out. And I think that it, like you were saying earlier, you're trying to understand it. I think it can be hard to understand if it's never happened to you. And, like, for me, I don't think I've never experienced something so egregious as, like, the police officer example. But I've had, like, family members say to me, like, oh, like, your top is too low cut for this event. And I don't know if that would count as slut shaming per se, but definitely I think that's a way of trying to sort of put something on me that I don't think is accurate, you know? Like, it was not, I mean, it's hard to even explain, like, I want to be all defensive, like, oh, it wasn't that low cut. I mean, that's kind of, like, how I dress. My tops are low cut, but it wasn't like I was burying, like, my entire cleavage at a family gathering. But that was how it was perceived. And then I think people don't realize that, like, when someone says that to you, whether it's a family member or an authority figure or your friends or your peers or whatever, like, it does affect you, especially if it happens over and over. I mean, I think, of course, if you're hearing that all the time, you're going to question, oh, like, is there something wrong with wearing a short skirt? Or is there something wrong with, you know, making out with a stranger at a bar or whatever it is? Like, I think that there's, even though we have made a lot of progress and there is more sexual freedom overall, I think there's still a lot of ways that if you do this one thing, you're okay, but if you do this other thing, you're slutty, and, like, that's bad, and you shouldn't do that. And I think that, you know, women, and I mean, I can only speak to this country, but hear those messages over and over, and I think, like, those still exist, you know, like, for, especially for girls, but also women. I mean, like, you know, if you sleep with someone on the first date, or if you sleep with too many people, I think there's still a sort of, like, I don't know what that exact number would be, but I feel like there's still this idea, oh, okay, you're allowed to, like, and it's not like people expect you to be a virgin, you know, till you're, you know, till whatever age, but I think there's still this, like, unspoken, okay, but if you sleep with too many people, then you're, you know, just slutty. And
yeah, there's that, there's that Chris Rock joke where he says, you know, a girl, no matter what, if it's more than, if you're with a woman and she says that she slept with more than you, you're always going to be mad. And he was definitely exaggerating, but he was just jumping on the number. And when she tells him, he's like, two, are you kidding me? Two? And definitely, you know, in my younger days, you know, I remember my girlfriend at the time, maybe she had slept with like three guys and I was, or it was two and she didn't tell me about the third one. But, you know, I was, what, 19, 20. And I just remember being crushed. And, you know, I would like to say that I've definitely matured and gotten a lot better at it. But you're totally right. And even now, a lot of my good friends, they have daughters, you know, ranging from the age of 4 to 3 months. And already the type of conversations that we have is just like, you know, while they're very much in love with their daughters, they're very just concerned about just so many things that women go through. And also, you know, we've been young men, we are men, and we just kind of, the way our minds work, not necessarily in a disrespectful way, but just thinking about what your daughter's going to go through is definitely very stressful. But I would like to think that being from New York, I'm from New York and a lot of my friends are from New York, it's just, while we aren't perfect, you're just exposed to so many things where I don't want to call them trends, but people feel a lot more comfortable in their skin in New York. It's not 100% true, but you're very much exposed to a lot. My sister worked for the Gay Men's Health Crisis when I was a young kid. And just, you know, whenever if I went to work with her or whatever, just being exposed to homosexuality, having a gay roommate in college really kind of prepared me for everything, you know. I would like to think. I'm sure that there are times that I come off as insensitive to certain issues.
But, like, that's what I was sort of saying before, that it's not, like, I think sometimes some of these topics, like, say, same-sex marriage, it's framed as, okay, that only is affecting gay people. But I think that, you know, I think it's affecting all of us, in that, you know, that's your neighbors, your friends, I mean, maybe it's not your friends, like, but I mean, I guess I'm saying, like, you know, I think that it's not just an isolated issue. Like, I think that more freedom, and by freedom I mean, like, to be able to even think about, okay, like, maybe I want to go to a sex party, and, like, that's okay. And, like, you know, and not have to worry about, like, if I do this thing, will so-and-so think I'm slutty, or will this person judge me? And I don't think that's just women. I think men worry about being judged, too. But I think women get it in a different way, you know. And,
definitely.
And I think a lot of that, like what you were talking about, where if a guy is sort of, like, upset or jealous of you know, a woman having slept with more people. I mean, I think a lot of that comes from insecurity. Like, I think there's this level of, oh, well, you know, will I measure up? And, you know, I think a lot of that is in the person's own head. You know, I mean, maybe it's not entirely, but I think that people sort of, that's their knee-jerk reaction, like, oh, well, if they slept with a lot more people than I am, then they're going to be expecting me to be like this or like this. And I think that, I mean, we all, obviously, it's human nature to be nervous if you're dating someone new and you're not sure what to expect. But I think sometimes we bring a lot of baggage with us and sort of put it on the other person preemptively. And it's not necessarily the case. Like, you don't really know what they think unless you ask them.
Yeah, it's always hard questions to ask. But let me ask another question about you. I feel like we've been talking about topics in general. So when was your kind of like aha moment? Like, this is what I'm going to do, you know, because it sounds like in the beginning you saying that you kind of jumped around. You were in law school, and then you're thinking about journalism school. You tried admin. When were you like, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm so happy with this decision, and I'm, you know, this is really cool what I'm doing.
I don't know if I ever had that single moment. I do know that I published my first erotica short story in 2000 in an anthology called Starfucker, and that was a book about celebrity erotica, and my story was about Monica Lewinsky, and that was super exciting. Like, that was, I had just left law school, and I was working this admin job, and I was like, oh my God, my story is in a book. It was really exciting. I mean, I literally cried when I saw it in the book. But
what year was that? I'm sorry. What year was that?
That was 2000.
Okay.
I was really like excited and honored, and but I didn't think, oh, I could do this for a living. I thought, okay, wow, that's cool. I published one story, and then I wrote another one, and I got that published. You know, and I was writing them every couple months or something. And then, you know, a lot of things sort of just happened. I mean, and I'm not saying they just happened. Like, I was in the right place at the right time, and I was building up, you know, my name in that field. But in 2004, I got asked to interview at Penthouse Variations, which is an adult magazine. It's like,
yeah,
published by Penthouse. It's sexy letters.
Very aware.
Whatever. And I wound up getting that job, so I left my admin job, and then I was, you know, full-time in that world. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm making a living with words. Like, I'm an editor. This is my real job now. And then that also that same year is when I got asked to write a column for the Village Voice. So,
lusty lady.
That was a big turning point in that, you know, all these things happened that I didn't plan for them. I mean, I was thrilled to be doing them. And, you know, if back in college when I was looking at, like, what could I do with my life? I mean, if someone had said to me, oh, well, you'll go on to be a magazine editor and a newspaper columnist, you know, I would have said, wow, that's awesome. But I actually don't think I could have set out to, like, say, okay, I want to do this. I mean, maybe I could have, but I didn't. And I would say the same for when then I got laid off from that job in 2011, and you know, I had done a lot of things in between. I ran a reading series in New York every month for, like, an erotic reading series, and I'd edited a bunch of books and done a lot of writing, but I never thought, oh, I could do this on my own without a full-time job. And I would say, like, you know, it still is a process of learning how to do that, because it's, you know, it's very hard to make a living writing.
Right.
And it's a constant, like, I feel like I constantly have to be learning about how to, you know, do my job better, like how to pitch different publications and how to, you know, reach different people with my books. And, you know, sometimes things come along that surprise me, like some of my audiobooks, most of my books are available in print, ebook and audiobook. And some of the audiobooks have been, like, so much better than the print and ebook combined. Like, they've outsold them many times over. And I never would have thought that, because I don't really listen to audiobooks myself. So I've had to learn about, like, that market. So I feel like there's just, it was never one moment. It's kind of been a series of moments of, oh, I can do this you know, full-time job, and then I can write a magazine, I mean, newspaper column, and, you know, I can pitch the New York Times this year, and I feel like it's scary because there's never, like, no day is the same for me. It's not like I sit down and do, you know, the same thing I did yesterday. Like, I'm working on different, I mean, it's not necessarily literally a different article every day. Like, sometimes I might work on an article over a couple of days, but every week is different. And that's exciting because it means that if suddenly I have an idea for something, I can take the time and focus on that. But it's also, there's not a lot of stability to that. Like, you know, I don't know how much money I'll be making next month or next year. And I don't really have a lot I can plan on in terms of financial stability. So that is a little scary, but it's also exciting. And that also goes back to why I don't only want to limit myself to writing about sex, because, you know, yes, a lot of publications have, you know, columns or articles about sex, but, you know, I also like to write about other random interests of mine. You know, like, there was something, I didn't go to it, I actually think you're not allowed to write about it, but I'm fascinated by it. I'm really into, like, coupons, and there's some sort of, and also contests, and I know there are coupon conventions and also sweepstakes conventions, and that fascinates me. Like, that is something I would love to just go and write about and learn about. Like, I love just hearing about people who are obsessed with whatever their thing is. But in this case, I sort of share that obsession, but I'm not as in, you know, as into it as someone who might go to those. So, like, I love that I can even think about, oh, okay, I'm interested in this topic, maybe I'll just study it and write about it someday. And, you know, that's that freedom of making it up every day as I go along is amazing. Like, I love it, but it also, there are times when I'm a little jealous of my friends who have, like, vacation time and they still get a salary for it. Like,
yeah.
When I'm on vacation, it's very hard for me to actually be on vacation. And in January, I went to Curacao with one of my best friends, and, like, we had an argument at one point because I had some work to do, and I was like, oh, I'll be out in 45 minutes, and then, like, an hour and a half later, I was still working, and, like, naturally, she was not happy, and I felt bad. But it was, you know, it's hard because...
That's the grind. That's how it goes. And, you know, the grass is always greener. You know, people will tell you that have a normal 9-to-5 and paid vacation that it really sucks working for people, because sometimes you feel that you're better than what they're making you do. And at least when you're in your own element, you're your own boss, even though you have kind of these insecurities of, you know, how much money am I making? There's something, I'm pretty sure there's something really satisfying about doing your own thing and kind of making things come to life. And also, you have followers. I mean,
I'm very grateful. I love what I do. And I also, you know, I've diversified. Like, I started teaching, I used to teach mostly in-person erotica writing classes, and now I do it online. And that's a whole new world. It's really cool because people have taken my classes from Europe and from Australia, and because it's all written, so, like, they can log in anytime they want. And to me, that is just really cool that we live in a time when people can do that. And, like, you know, people from around the world can be, you know, forming this community and learning together. So, yeah, I mean, overall, I'm very happy with what I do, but it forces me to really just be on my toes all the time and, like, learning about what can I do better. Like, I never want to just sit back and be like, oh, well, you know, everything, even when things are going well, I always want to think about, okay, well, what could I be striving for? Not necessarily today, like, I don't want to put all that pressure on myself every single day, but, like, what goals do I have for, you know, we're coming up to a new year, so, like, what do I want to accomplish next year that I haven't done this year? And try to set realistic goals.
Definitely.
You know, so
that's great. Really cool. I have another question for you before we let you go. So I'm not sure now if you have a husband or a boyfriend, but or a partner, whomever, whatever. When you were single, and then, you know, things were really picking up for you, how was the dating scene like for you in New York? You know, you're a writer. You focus a lot on sex and erotica. I mean, when you would tell someone that you're going on a date with, this is what you do, how did they receive that? Did things get awkward?
That was complicated. I do live with my boyfriend. We've been together almost 4 years.
Nice.
I'll go back to that in a sec. But, like, when I was single, you know, there were some people that, I wouldn't say they didn't care, but, you know, they could separate what I did for a living from who I am. At the same time, it is complicated because I write often about my personal life. And I do remember one time I wrote about this thing that happened in my relationship. And it was about, like, I was sleeping over at my boyfriend's house. And I don't remember what time I went to sleep. Let's just say 10 o'clock. And, you know, it was like at 11, he went out to meet with his friend or something. And it was like a female friend. And then he was out really late. I think it was something like, say, 1 o'clock in the morning. I woke up and he still wasn't back. And that was a little weird because I was at his place. I may have gotten some of the times wrong. But anyway, I wrote an essay about how, like, that was a little weird for me. And I showed it to him before I published it. And he was like, okay, that's fine. And, you know, we talked about the, you know, whatever my issues were. And then it got published, and then people were commenting, like, oh, he's such, you know, I don't know. I didn't read the comments, but I guess they were talking about him, and he read the comments, and he was really weirded out by it. And
never read the comment section. That's just a bad idea.
I totally understood. Like, I understood why he was freaked out, but I also, it was sort of like, I felt like a little unfair because he didn't have a problem with what I wrote, you know, but he was having a problem with what these other people were writing, and, you know, I can't control that. And, you know, he was like, oh, well, they're saying this about me, and that's not really true. And I'm like, well, I know that's not true, and you know that's not true, so it's not really an issue. But, like, I think because it was out there in the world, you know, he had a problem with it. And it's a tricky balance. I mean, it's still a tricky balance. I've been with my boyfriend for, you know, almost 4 years, and we're pretty much, you know, plan to be together the rest of our lives, but it's still, I don't know if I'd say it's a touchy subject, but it's a tension because he's much more private than I am, but he has acknowledged, like, he knows that's what I do for a living, and he's proud of me, but still, like, last month, I wrote about our sex life in Oprah's magazine, and, you know, that has millions of readers. And
my mother gets Oprah's magazine.
You know, yeah. I mean, I hoped that, you know, people he knows didn't come up to him and say, like, hey, you know, I read about your girlfriend's thing, you know, you're, you know, whatever, in that magazine. I mean, I think people are a little, you know, they're pretty, they wouldn't do that, hopefully. But it's an odd profession when you're writing about your personal life and it's not fiction. And, you know, you're saying, like, this is literally, like, what our relationship is like. And, you know, sometimes it's a balancing act. But he's never told me not to write about anything. You know, I think he just accepts that's how I process things. And the way I think of it is, you know, it's that he's not the intended audience for it because we've already discussed whatever it is. It's really about me working it out in my head and also, you know, wanting to talk about something in a broader context. But I would say, you know, I feel like there were times when I was, especially when I had my Village Voice column, I kind of wished, oh, maybe I should have used a pseudonym because, you know, it's hard. Even if you're not writing about the person you're on a date with now, they can read, like, about the time, you know,
archives.
Like, I did this crazy thing.
Yeah.
You know, and they can easily access that. And it's not like I have the equivalent. I can't just find the treasure trove of their sexual history.
The little black book. I had a friend who used to just write down all his exploits in a little black book.
Like, in detail or just, like,
The way he would say it, he would just write down as much detail as he can. He would just write everything down. This was a long time ago, but I'm sure.
That seems very dangerous in the wrong hands.
Yeah, it is, but maybe I shouldn't have said that, but whatever. But
no, I mean, like I think it's cool because also, like, I mean, you think you're going to remember, but 20 years later, you know, I mean, I do think I remember everyone and stuff, but I don't remember all, like, exactly what happened. You know, I don't remember, like,
what he was wearing. Yep. Yeah. I mean, I'm just being PG by saying what he was wearing, but like, I feel you. I totally understand what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, and so, you know, and I don't know, like it's a tension. I think anyone who writes about their personal life, even if they're not writing about their sex life, if you're writing about your feelings, you know, whatever that is, like, it can be a tension between what you want to share with the world and what you share with one person. And, you know, I think sometimes people assume that means, oh, well, you write about your sex life, therefore you are writing about every single thing that you do with your partner. And I don't. Like, we still have plenty of things that are just for us.
Right.
They're just not the same things that someone else would, you know, have just for them. Like my level of privacy is, my boundaries around that are different from my partner's and are different from, I'm sure, lots of other people's.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I totally agree. I mean, you know, you write about sex, so of course your boundaries are going to be different. Some people are very private. They don't want to talk about, you know, their girlfriend or boyfriend's privates or what they do, yeah, or issues or problems, but
I mean, and I don't think everyone should. I mean, I think it's very individual, like how you deal with that. And, you know, I don't, maybe someday I won't write about my personal life. I mean, probably I will, like, let's be honest, but, you know, I don't know. And it's, you know, I'm thinking about having children. I have no idea how much about that I'll want to share. I actually think that if I have kids, I'll probably be one of those people who doesn't, like, post their photo all over the place. Like, I'll probably have it super filtered. Like, I have friends who have, like, a private Facebook group that, you know, they have to approve everyone who's in it, where they post photos of their kids.
No, yeah, two of my really good friends, both of them are women. They don't really post that many pictures of their babies online. They don't. They're just not comfortable with it, and I get it. Three of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think I might. I mean, as much as, like, I like looking at photos of my friends' kids, and, you know, I have a lot of friends who I think would like to see those. Like, I don't think I would post them for everyone to see, because
right.
To me, that's my, like, level of privacy. Like, I think I would feel uncomfortable with that. I think why I feel okay about writing about my own life is, like, I'm choosing to do that. But if I had a kid, you know, they don't know that I'm posting their photos
right.
over.
Very fair. Is there anything you would like to plug before we sign off for the night?
Well, I have a new book coming out on November 10th, 30 Dates, and that is also my 40th birthday.
Happy birthday.
So I feel like there's some sort of kismet that it's coming. The pub date is literally on my birthday, so that's very exciting. I am teaching a new class. I don't know if this will air before that or after that, but for litreactor.com starting November 3rd. And I'm working on a website for next year to teach more online classes, like, on my own. I don't have the URL yet, but if you follow me on Twitter at Raquelita, RAQUELITA, or get my newsletter on my website at rachelkramerbussell.com, you can find out about that. I'm hoping to do different kinds of writing classes, like one day long or several weeks long, different, you know, topics and stuff.
Great. Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
I hope that we can do this again, and I really hope that some of the fans can catch up on some of your work.
Thank you.
And
I had a good time.
All right, y'all. Thanks a lot for tuning in. Be on the lookout for this episode on iTunes and the MID3 website, MID3.com, MID3network.com, excuse me, and look us up on Facebook on MID3. This was fun. Hope to talk to y'all again soon. Peace.
Yeah, you already know. Come on. You know what time it is. Hey, yo, I represent Queens. Please let them know.